Welcome back to Radio Boston. I am Tiziana Deering, and we are talking sports. Team USA is taking on Sweden right now in the Women's World Cup. I see that the USA is ahead 1-0.
Already?
Over Sweden. Actually, nearing the end of the first half, so we're into it now. With us, our WBUR Sports and Society reporter, Shira Springer. Hi, Shira.
Hi.
It is time. And also here is WBUR and NPR sports commentator, Bill Littlefield. Bill, hello.
Hello. I think there should be an emeritus behind but thank you. I appreciate
it. I'm going to call you Emeritus Bill for the rest of this interview. All right. Let's talk Team USA and Sweden. There is some history behind this matchup. Listeners, you might recall, 2016 Summer Olympics, Sweden defeated the Americans in the quarterfinals. But U.S. forward Kristen Press says the team is looking forward.
The team feels very different from the group that we took to the Olympics. But at the same time, despite the fact that it's been 3 years, you don't forget the taste in your mouth when you fail and when you lose in a world championship. And I think that there's a little bit of that that will definitely act as motivation. And you always play to win and to never have that feeling again.
So rivalry makes it more fun. This is the last game of the group stage. So even if the USA loses, they're locked in. But listening to that tape and from what you've seen of the World Cup so far, is there some urgency for the US to win this game, Shira?
Well, I think you want to go into the knockout round, which is the next series of games, on a winning streak. You don't want to go in with a loss. It sort of leaves a bad taste in your mouth and maybe, mm-hmm. you know, causes you to question your confidence a little bit. So I think you always want to have a winning streak heading into, you know, a one and done situation, a situation where one loss and you're out of the tournament. But I don't think there's any real sense of urgency because it's an interesting scenario for the U.S. If they win and win their group, they are on a path to face France in the quarterfinals. So that's a little bit down the road. But France is one of the powerhouse teams in the tournament and, of course, has home field advantage, so to speak, in their home. The tournament's being played in their home country. So there has been some questioning. Does the U.S. want to perhaps not play Sweden as strongly as they might so they could avoid facing France in the quarterfinals? But as you might expect, the women on the U.S. team are like, heck no. We want the toughest competition we can get. We want to show that we won this thing by going through the toughest teams to get the title if they end up winning the title. I don't want to presume anything because it is a tough tournament.
Well,
there
you
is
don't
some
jinx
parity.
Anybody.
That's true. And
no
there is
jinxing.
There is more parity in this tournament than there has been in past tournaments.
All right, Bill, so let's talk about that parity. So should we be expecting other 13-0 blowouts or is it going to tighten up now and we're going to see really close
the latter.
Matches?
I don't know how many matches will be really close. Soccer's a kind of a, as somebody once said, you know, it's any game with a ball in it is an unpredictable game. Balls tend to bounce in peculiar ways. But I don't think you're going to see another 13-0 game. You may see some 4-0 games.
Which in the world of soccer is usually what a blowout
whitewash.
Looks
absolutely,
like.
Absolutely, yeah. No question. It's interesting the way Shira put it. I agree 100% that it's better to go in to the next stage 3-0 than 3-1 or 3-0-1, but 2-0-1. But the kind of operative knowledge, the way that people talk about it in soccer is you go into the group stage with the goal of getting out of the group stage. And it doesn't really matter how you do it, as long as you do it and you get to the next part of the tournament. That having been said, obviously there is baggage in this game, mm-hmm. and the U.S. would rather beat Sweden than not.
And not carry that sort of that
trail
behind them. All right, so that 13-0 reference I made was the game that the U.S. played against Thailand, and I really want to talk about this. The U.S. team faced some criticism for the way they celebrated those goals, spinning around, kicking heels in
the air. Here
comes
the fun part,
sliding, let's do this. This happened over a week ago.
By the way, we're getting an in-studio demonstration here.
That's right. My arms are up. Folks are still talking about this. Happened more than a week ago, but this still chatter beyond just sports circles. U.S. forward Alex Morgan, who scored 5 goals during that game, had some words for the critics.
These are goals that we have dreamt of our entire life. I mean, I'm going to celebrate Mal Pugh's goal. I'm going to celebrate Sam Lewis and Roosevelt. This is our first World Cup, and I'm so proud of them. And so I couldn't have dreamt of scoring 5 goals in a World Cup. So it's incredible for us all. And I'm happy just ignoring those comments.
So there are two things at play here, and I'm going to ask you both about both of them. The first thing at play is just the question of sportsmanship. From a sportsmanship perspective, Shira, did they celebrate too much?
No.
Tell me why.
For precisely the reasons you heard there. You know, for some players, this was their first World Cup goals. It was their first World Cup game. This is the biggest stage for women's soccer in the world. They have been working for 4 years to get to this point. They deserve to celebrate how they want to celebrate. Goals are a big deal. They are tough to come by. Even if it didn't look that way against Thailand, they are still tough to come by. And players should be allowed to celebrate how they want to celebrate. And we shouldn't be policing how, you know, these celebrations. To me, that is so wrong.
But a lot of sports police celebrations.
Yes. That's an interesting point, because the NFL finally got so discouraged with the with the end zone celebrations that they made rules about how long those celebrations
And the NFL is poorer
for it, right?
And with baseball, Shira and I were speaking about this before. There are lots of old traditional sports writers and not so old traditional sports writers who are very upset when somebody hits a home run, drops the bat, and watches the ball leave the park before he, you know, deigns to run around the bases.
Well, the pitcher's going to clock that person next time they're at bat.
Maybe. But there are a lot of people who just regard that as poor sportsmanship. So I don't think it's entirely a gender issue, but it is also not – you can't separate it from what the criticism of females has been, female athletes particularly. If a female is loud, she's shrill. If a female is angry, she's out of control. This is something that obviously goes on way beyond sports. And the upside of this whole discussion, it seems to me, is people are talking about this and they are saying, hey, can you legitimately criticize female athletes in a different way than you criticize male athletes? And the answer, it seems to me, obviously, is no, you can't. If you want to say it's bad sportsmanship, well, then you've got to bring in all the bad sportsmanship on the male side in various other sports and talk about that as well. Mm-hmm. If you want to say these are just elite athletes, very excited about playing at the elite level, Morgan's comment indicated, some of these women have never been on this stage before. They've never had hundreds of thousands of people watching them play soccer before. Of course they're excited, and of course they're going to celebrate. And I think you have to have a certain amount of understanding for that.
Shira.
Yeah, and I think Bill brings up great points about the larger context in which this is all playing out. And I think another part of that larger context is the larger sports context, which is throughout the history of women's sports, there has been this emphasis and this preference, unfortunately, that female athletes look feminine, and there's been criticism when they aren't feminine
enough.
It's
the whole ladylike lair.
Exactly. I mean, and this is not, you know, sort of some distant past. You know, the women on Brazil's national soccer team have had to fight with the leaders of the Brazilian Federation, you know, and there have been comments about the women not looking feminine enough and the men, you know, the leaders of that federation making sexist comments. So there's a whole, I don't want to say subtext, but a whole history here of particularly men in powers of position in soccer being critical of the way women look, the way women behave. I mean, we were talking before about the movie in a League of Their Own, that baseball movie where you saw the
about
women
the women's baseball teams during World War II.
Exactly, getting etiquette classes. And so
I think about Serena Williams versus John McEnroe in tennis.
Exactly.
He was a golden boy for being a brat, and she gets in trouble every time she yells on the court.
Exactly.
That's a little bit skewed, I think, because there were numbers of us who regarded John McEnroe as a magnificent tennis player who couldn't control himself and acted like a jerk.
Fair enough.
I could dig out some of the things I wrote back in the day. But you're right that Serena Williams came in for more criticism when she went after the official than a male player would have under the same circumstance. What I think of when some of the points that Shira has made, FIFA not that long ago said
Sepp Blatter, the
greatest improvement that could be made in women's soccer is that they play in shorter shorts.
Yeah.
And he thought it was funny.
Yeah, yeah. Not only do I think he thought it was funny, but I think he was also pretty serious about it.
He meant it and thought.
Yeah, so I mean, so in that context, this takes on a whole other meaning.
Aren't women already making more money, earning more money for soccer than men? So isn't that just
revenue?
They're not earning more money.
Yeah, I was going to say, they're not.
But the raising more revenue for the sport.
Yes, yes.
In fact, we know they're not earning more money.
Yes, yes. I mean, there's the equal, exactly. There's the equal pay fight. But, you know, I think there was figures that were just released that appeared in the Wall Street Journal that over the last 3 or 4 years since the last Women's World Cup, the women's team has earned more revenue.
Yeah, it has to do to some extent with the fact that the women's team tends to stay in the tournament longer than the men's team.
It also helps when you're actually in the tournament, considering the men didn't make the 2018
Men's World Cup. Qualifying for the tournament counts as being in the tournament.
All right. Before we start getting callers when we didn't even ask for any, I think I'm going to move us on to a new subject. It's a much more sobering subject. I want to turn to the latest news on David Ortiz. Authorities in the Dominican Republic said yesterday that his shooting earlier this month in the DR, they're saying it was a case of mistaken identity. Here is prosecutor Jean-Alain Rodriguez speaking through an interpreter to say that the intended target was a man named David Fernandez, who was sitting at the same table in the bar where Ortiz was shot.
Because of the way that everything was placed, that the pants that David Fernandez were white, the same are the ones that David Ortiz was wearing.
Okay, there are a lot of rumors swirling around. Authorities say the attack was ordered by a drug trafficker who hired hitmen to kill Fernandez, who is his cousin. Shira, the eye rolling during that tape was pretty impressive, so let's go to you.
Yeah, I mean, I listened to the press conference yesterday, and, you know, the attorney general for the Dominican Republic went to great lengths to say, you know, we have evidence, we have scientific proof of all this, but this really strains credibility, that this is a case of mistaken identity, that they, you know, they weren't after David Ortiz, but after someone else. Listen, David Ortiz is one of the most recognizable athletes in the world. He's one of the most beloved and recognized athletes in the Dominican Republic. And not only that, he's a fairly large human being, and with a, I would say, describe it as a very distinct silhouette. So whether you are behind him or in front of him, he's very easily recognizable. And if you watch the video of the shooting, it took place at extraordinarily close range. The shooter was maybe 2 or 3 feet behind David Ortiz.
I'm sensing you do not find this credible.
No, and I'm sorry.
Me too. I'm kind of getting that impression too.
Yeah. It's just, you know, you have evidence, you have scientific evidence. I mean, I'd like to see just the wearing the same clothes. It doesn't pass sort of the smell test for me.
All right, so we've got about 30 seconds left. Bill, I'm going to shift gears one more time to basketball.
Uh-oh.
We've got the NBA draft tonight, but the big news is the Celtics are now looking at losing two players. Al Horford, who's the latest to be expected to leave, along with Kyrie Irving. What does this suggest for the season coming up this fall? And, you know, 20 seconds.
Well, a lot of my friends who are Celtics fans suggest that it couldn't be better.
The best thing to do would be to,
like in a Scrabble
to get
game,
rid of Kyrie.
If it's a Scrabble game where you have lousy, you turn in all your tiles and get new ones.
So Kyrie is the Q, or is the Q tile.
You got a Z, you got a couple of X's.
Idea.
I don't have any idea how this is all going to turn out. I think talking about basketball in June is a fool's errand.
Anyway,
I hope for the best.
All right. But WBUR Sports and Society reporter Shira Springer, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Also, emeritus WBUR and NPR sports commentator Bill Littlefield, thanks.
Great pleasure.
Finally today, we are going to go out on some different music. Here's Radio Boston's Zoe Mitchell.
Yeah, opening at Boston's Aganis Arena this week is Cirque du Soleil's Corteo. And in addition to all of the acrobats, the ringmaster of the show, Mr. Loyal, is played by a world-class whistler. Geert Chatrou is from the Netherlands, and he won the World Whistling Championships in 2004, 2005, and in 2008.
So I didn't know we had a World Whistling Championship. What does he perform?
He performs basically everything. You heard Sweet Caroline at the top, but he's also got this wide repertoire of music he loves. When I spoke with him, he mentioned everything from Jimi Hendrix to the music of the Renaissance. And he actually won one of his world championships with the American National Anthem. Here's a little bit of that.
Oh,
Plus, he also performed his rendition of Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star, which he actually does on the show for me as well. Let's hear that.
This is awesome. It's awesome. So he's really approaching whistling as a musician, right?
Yeah, and that's kind of what he calls himself. You know, for him, whistling, it's his instrument, just like a piccolo would be or a flute.
I did a flute concert by Mozart, whistling it instead of using a flute. And of course, it looks really weird, you know, a big guy producing all this high notes. But if you hit every note and you hit it right, then people understand it's real music.
All right, we have to have more. So do you have something for us to go out with?
Of course I do. So here's something that people might have as their ringtone. It's from the last movement of Johann Sebastian Bach's Suite Number 2 in B minor, and I really loved his rendition.
That is Radio Boston's Zoe Mitchell, and it's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, and Paris Alston. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.